This is a CNA podcast.
I'm Lynn Suling. This is Heart of the Matter, where we take a deep dive each week into one of the biggest news stories. Countries around the world are easing restrictions after weeks, even months of being in lockdown. It feels like eternity for people cooped up at home and businesses that had to shutter. But are we prepared for what comes after these restrictions are lifted? How are countries walking that tightrope to balance competing demands to reopen while keeping the virus at bay? And is it clear what can or cannot be done and why going forward? Calling in to tackle these questions with me are Pauline Strongman, Dean of Students and Professor of Sociology at SMU.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Associate Professor Alex Cook, Vice Dean of Research at NUS Saucycock School of Public Health.
Hi there.
And Ollie Barrett, our correspondent in London. Hi, Ollie.
Hi, guys.
Now, I just want to take a step back and start by thinking about lockdown. It was seen as draconian, blunt, even an aberration when Wuhan, the first city, started that so many months ago. Even then, we were grasping at straws, trying to wrap our head around the idea of a lockdown. There were references to the plague and the Spanish flu, and it kind of made lockdown seem like a ridiculous choice. So the question is, how did we get to a stage where lockdowns became the norm, and what led that change of heart?
This being a global pandemic, by the time it came to us in Singapore, we had seen it happen in so many other cities and countries in the world that we take it as an inevitable step that we had to move. However, as a sociologist, you know, when we say lockdown, it's not the same globally. There are cultural differences, there are legal differences to what each country pushed out. The gray area is what makes it difficult for the ordinary citizen on the street. Most people want to be law-conforming citizens because, by and large, the majority are fearful of this unknown virus. However, because of the fact that it is a new virus, and because we are dealing with social constructs that emerge every day in this discourse, there is an area where individuals are left to construct reality, and therefore you see all the confusion, the anxiety and the stress.
Ollie, I wanted to get you to weigh in here. As the UK was one of the first few countries that seem a bit tenuous when it comes to dealing with the coronavirus, how did the UK move so quickly into lockdown?
In a sense, it moved later than some of its European allies. That was interesting to watch. We know, by the way, from some of the minutes that have been published from the scientific discussions leading up to lockdown, that it was certainly considered by British scientists and behavioural modellers and politicians as well, that the British people might be less willing than some other populations to move into a lockdown situation. And that's perhaps why Britain moved a little bit later than some other countries. I mean, its trajectory of the outbreak was slightly behind some other countries as well, so that played into it. But I also vividly remember one of the press conferences at Downing Street in March, when Britain was not in lockdown yet, when Boris Johnson was asked if we did move into a more strenuous lockdown, you know, the police would be needed to enforce it in some way. And he laughed at the idea of that. Several days later, he was enforcing lockdown and the police were being involved to make sure that it was observed by the British people. One advantage, as I say, the UK did have in moving its population into a lockdown situation was that by that point, Italy, France, Spain, Ireland, other European countries too were already in it. And so that made it easier to take the population along with the idea, I think.
So Alex, from your perspective, do you think these restrictions have worked and by what measure? I mean, early on when we were thinking about this issue, a lot of countries say, I want to focus on flattening the curve and getting the numbers under control. In retrospect, it seems like hard-nosed realists would say it really was to avoid overwhelming healthcare capacities and it was more or less a stopgap measure. So for you, what boxes do these restrictions check off?
I don't think that lockdown actually has any impact on flattening the curve. It has the impact of slowing down the first part of the epidemic. But we're starting to see that in countries like Germany or South Korea, where they went into lockdown quite early and they've relaxed those lockdown measures, that the epidemic is starting to potentially bounce back again. The lockdown doesn't fundamentally change the transmissibility of the virus. In general, it only changes it during the period of lockdown. And so when you relax it, unless you have some other measures in place in order to keep transmissibility down, then you expect that you're going to see a resumption of the epidemic beyond lockdown. So it really has the impact of relieving some of the buildup of pressure on the healthcare system, buying some time in order to work out what to do next and what policies should be placed afterwards.
Alex, may I follow up on this? I mean, this is really intriguing for me as a sociologist, right? So given that Singapore is such a small city state, do you think that a lockdown for us might work more positively in containing the spread compared to larger countries?
Singapore is a very unusual case setting because it's a city and it's a country. Imagine the equivalent of locking down just London. That's a bit more challenging because where's the boundary with London and the rest of England? Whereas in Singapore, there's a clear boundary around about it. So that does make it slightly easier to implement lockdown in a Singapore context. There's a kind of acceptance of paternalism from the government, from the people of the country. If the government says that lockdown is necessary, I think that there'd be a lot more support in Singapore than there might have been in some other locations.
Pauline, are you advocating for stricter restrictions? Because now you're comparing Singapore's circuit breaker with lockdown.
Yeah.
And it seems to me you're suggesting that the differences are very vast.
I've just been penning my thoughts on the case in Singapore, and I feel that our strategy is very different from other countries, and it was simply because I think we are the only small city state dealing with this catastrophe. I'm not saying that we should go for stricter measures. I'm just watching the split curves that every day all of us are following eagerly, right? So today, the Singaporean PR spread is 2%, right? And all of us are like, oh, so relieved. You know, it's worth it, right? You know, having to delay our haircuts and so forth. But then concurrently, we also see that the foreign worker population continues to escalate. And of course, we are given explanations for why this is so because of the widespread testing and so forth. But nonetheless, speaking from a lay perspective, for measures like lockdown, shutdowns, restrictions to work, you have to get the buy-in of the ordinary person on the street. This is very difficult discourse that we are facing. There are two sets of numbers every day. I'm sorry, you know, to be focusing on Singapore, but that's the only construct I know. Having Alex on the podcast is great because I want to ask Alex to distill this for the ordinary person down the street, right? The circuit breaker, as we call it here, is done at tremendous cost, right? While we are law-abiding, it really takes a toll on us, particularly on the more vulnerable groups, particularly on those who are not wired up, and particularly on the elderly. So it's a very painful 4 weeks already. And I think Singaporeans just want to hear that this is working. Otherwise, why are we suffering like that, right? I would love to hear Alex's perspective on this.
I'll hold that thought for a little bit because I kind of want Ollie to come in. And Ollie, can you tell us what the mood has been in London? Because there's been weeks of that lockdown, it hasn't been easy. There's some bubbling resentment. And if we look at the US, for instance, there have been huge protests, armed protests even. People are frustrated from staying in each day. There's uncertainty on jobs and life events. Can you give us a sense of what the public mood about lockdowns is in the UK? Is there some level of support for it?
There's a huge level of support for it. The government has been really surprised how much the British public has supported lockdown and how much it's abided by the rules so far. And that was playing into the government's thinking about timing in all of this. It really was worried that the British people wouldn't put up with the rules and restrictions that some other countries were putting in place. But the polling shows that actually the British people are more positive, more supportive of lockdown than many, many other particularly comparable European nations. And that's actually now one of the problems for the government, is trying to unwind lockdown gradually and trying to bring a population along with you that has been very supportive of the lockdown in the first place and might be scared about going back to work or sending children back to school. So yeah, broadly, the British population has been very supportive. But at the same time, the scientists and the modellers are very aware that that only lasts so long. There have been examples of things starting to fray around the edges a little bit. And I think that's why we've started to see some of those restrictions being relaxed on how much time you can spend outdoors, that kind of thing. And again, going back to when the lockdown was brought in, the scientific advisors here in the UK always said in the days leading up to lockdown being enforced that we have to get the timing right, because if we bring it in too early, then people might get fatigued by the time the peak of the outbreak hits, and that would be disastrous for trying to slow the spread of the outbreak.
So I think this is the best time to bring in Alex. The irony is that people are saying that sometimes you wonder whether if you had these restrictions earlier on, like the way New Zealand did, you know, go in hard, go in early, like what Jacinda Ardern said, that the virus transmission might be contained. But it sounds like you're saying that we don't want to go too early on this. So Alex, is there a sense of how long should these sort of restrictions stay on? We know that Wuhan had 76 days or so. In a lot of European countries, land about 50 to 60 days. Is there some sort of a best practice when it comes to these restrictions before fatigue sets in?
I think all countries are kind of making it up as they go along. It's an unprecedented situation. We have to look back to medieval times to find situations which are similar to that. There's two separate things, looking at the duration of lockdown and looking at the timing of lockdown. They're related to each other, but the impact on the epidemic in different ways. If you had gone into lockdown in Singapore really early, then what would the impact have been? You would still have seen the outbreaks in dorms. The way to work the lockdown is supposed to work. It's supposed to reduce the number of contacts you have in the general community. And the quid pro quo is that you'll have more contacts at home because you spend more time at home during the lockdown. So in foreign worker dorms, they're not able to isolate themselves from the rest of the people that they're living with. And so if you have any infections coming into the dorm, then it will spread like wildfire. So a circuit breaker effectively is helping with preventing transmission in the general community, people who are able to isolate at home, keep a bit more distance from each other. At worst, maybe infect the three or four people that you live with rather than infecting the hundreds of people in the same building. If we had moved into lockdown earlier then I think there's still a risk that we would have quite large outbreaks in the dorms. But even if we had not, we'd be in a situation where we'd have a handful of cases, hundreds, maybe 1,000 cases in the community. Maybe we'd have got down to zero cases by now. But at some point, we have to open up again. When we open up, if we have importation of cases from overseas, for example, 250,000 people in normal times cross from Malaysia over to Singapore to work. If that's the case, then we would have importations into the country afterwards, which would make that early period of lockdown effectively meaningless, because all that we would have done is slightly prolonged for that short period of time how long it was until the epidemic took place. So I think that it will be important moving beyond circuit breaker to think about how we can engineer an environment in which there's sustainable distancing over the medium to long term, so that we don't need to go into circuit breaker again, or if we do, we can push it back for as long as possible and have as long a period of time without having the similar kind of measures as we have just now.
So it's very interesting you mentioned safe distancing, and one of the questions that I would have for Pauline, for instance, is do you think people have gotten the hang of this safe distancing during this COVID crisis, and are you confident that people can be counted on to have that high level of readiness? I already see like temperature screening, QR codes on malls and whatnot, and you know, there are rules and penalties. So do you think that people have been shaped by this whole period?
The problem we have in Singapore is when there is policing, of course we will abide, right? But when the COVID ambassadors are missing, here is where liberties are taken, because it's not humanly, I think for us intuitively, to have that safe distance between two individuals. I find this a very challenging issue to grapple with as an academic. You're dealing with human behavior, trying to adapt to an emerging crisis. But this emerging crisis is emerging, right? There's so little that we understand of it. So like what Alex had very, very eloquently argued, that this is going to work for us only if once, you know, circuit breaker is lifted, we continue to behave as we are doing now. That's the only way that, you know, we can buy time before a vaccine is developed. But the problem is, for the ordinary man on the street, the minute the circuit breaker is lifted, the interpretation is, okay, it's green light. Everything is back to normal again. So I hear the government taking great pains, you know, leading up to 2nd June, every day reminding us that it cannot go back to normal. We have to adopt and adapt a new norm. But it is easier said than done, because I think in that few weeks post June 2nd, there would have to be a lot more policing on the ground so that you have circuit breaker lifted to facilitate some flow back into the economy. However, concurrently, in terms of the practice of everyday life, the circuit breaker is still on in that sense, right? You're supposed to abide by the new norm now. You're supposed to remember not to sit next to each other, not to touch each other, not to be so close to each other. That is a tremendous challenge, because it just goes against so much of what we term normal behavior. Sometimes we think that, you know, this has been going on forever, but seriously, you know, this was just April, March, you know, when this just overnight our world turned upside down. This is the big challenge for us in Singapore.
But is that really the case? I mean, I think about how the WHO has announced today and said that the coronavirus may not go away, may not be wiped out completely. And I know, Ollie, you've probably just woken up right now and read that piece of news. Is there a sense that going forward, even though governments might lift circuit breakers or lockdowns, that people's lives won't be very different? People's lives will have to adapt to this new normal. We are banking on the vaccine to be found and drug treatments, but the reality is that there's really no certainty and there's still that risk of asymptomatic transmissions. What is the mood in London reading that news report today?
I've been up for hours, by the way. I woke up.
You're an early riser.
Yeah, I'm an early riser. And I read that headline that's been circulating from the WHO, and I was surprised that it was surprising to people. Certainly here in the UK, the scientists, particularly Chief Medical Officer Chris Whitty, have been saying repeatedly in our daily COVID-19 press briefings that we should absolutely not rely on the fact that there might be a vaccine soon. There might not be one at all, and that we will therefore have to have some kind of measures in place for potentially quite a long time. That wasn't a huge surprise, I don't think, to people here in the UK. I don't know whether that's different in other countries. But I also wanted to pick up on what Alex and Pauline were saying, which I totally agree with, which is, to paraphrase you guys, I hope you don't mind, effectively that all the governments are making this up as they go along because no one's ever experienced really anything quite like this. And that leads into the other point I wanted to make, which is that no one really knows what's working and why yet. You know, the science isn't all in, the data isn't all in. We don't know in the countries that had an early lockdown whether they will see a second wave bigger than the countries that had a more stringent lockdown that might have come later. That I get frustrated personally as a journalist seeing articles saying, you know, this country has succeeded for this reason, this country has failed because it didn't do this. We don't really know all of that stuff yet, and we won't do for quite some time.
But Alex, as someone who's looking at this and looking all the models at this, is there some sort of a framework that governments are using to monitor the state of the pandemic? In Singapore, we know that people are looking at certain data, certain infection numbers to be able to determine whether we can reopen the economy again and lift some restrictions. Is there a sense of what the best practice is?
Countries around the world are all poring over their data, trying to understand what is the local epidemiology in their country. We can look at cases, we can look at unlinked cases, we can look at other metrics such as deaths. I mean, we know that many cases are getting missed, and that's why the supposed case fatality rate fluctuates so widely between different countries, even of a similar economic status, like, for example, in Europe. So countries are definitely poring over the data all the time, trying to understand how far along the epidemic curve they are. And there's been some interesting studies starting to come out where serology has been used. This is basically looking at the presence of antibodies in people's blood to try to understand how many people have actually been infected as opposed to how many people do we know about so far because he went into the healthcare system. It's quite a depressing picture. Maybe only around 5% of the population of some of the worst affected Western European countries have been infected so far, meaning that if there is a second wave, it could be as bad, if not worse, than the first wave.
But where is the balance being responsive and reacting in a knee-jerk fashion? Because a lot of these announcements around the world on lifting lockdowns are usually made 1 or 2 weeks beforehand. But it's really awkward and even potentially problematic if the numbers go up in between for a range of reasons. I think about how, you know, South Korea had plans to open schools, but after a nightlife cluster emerged, they shut schools. Where is that balance? And are there any countries getting it right, roughly speaking?
The Singapore government is taking quite a good approach to this, which is that they're kind of layering the amount of interventions on top of each other, almost like how they control the housing market. So if it seems like things are getting a bit too hot, then put in a little bit extra intervention on top of what we currently have. If it looks like we're in control situation, relax the measures somewhat. So I think that kind of a responsive approach, it may seem like you're not able to plan ahead and really work out what you should be doing. But given the amount of uncertainty, that seems like actually the most sensible strategy right now.
I mean, I go back to what Pauline said, which is that people are really keen on lifting restrictions. And one school of thought that has emerged is that if you have testing, tracing, and tracking, you can lift these restrictions. You think about the outliers, you know, Hong Kong, Taiwan, South Korea, they didn't have a very stringent lockdown. And the sense is that if containment doesn't work, then suppression can. If you have all these apps that track people, you track mobile data, you track contact, surely you can lift restrictions. How confident are you of that approach? I guess I would open this question to everybody.
Alex, you know, I've been watching Taiwan and Hong Kong, and they seem to have been doing pretty well. I mean, Hong Kong in particular. What worked there and what went wrong for us here in Singapore?
So I think there's two main differences. as I see it. So one is around about closing off the border really early. Both Hong Kong and Taiwan shut off their borders, at least to China, almost immediately after first learning about the SARS coronavirus 2. We were fairly quick to shut off the flow from Wuhan and Hubei, and then eventually from China, but we were quite slow to shut off the flow from other places. And so actually a lot of the infections that we saw just before we went into circuit breaker, there were basically secondary cases from people returning back from the UK, Europe, US, etc. So returning Singaporeans, I guess, fleeing the situation over there. That's one of the big differences between the three polities. The other one is that we have this kind of structural issue with the dorms that it's not a problem that we can really solve in the middle of an outbreak. It almost seems now, looking back in retrospect, that it was almost bound to happen that if infection were to get into the foreign worker population, then it would spread in a way that would be very difficult to control. I'm not sure if either Hong Kong or Taiwan have a similar kind of semi-closed environment with so many people in such a small space. That's one of the main two reasons for the differences between the two approaches. If you actually look at the cases in the general community, then Singapore's been doing a pretty good job of controlling the number of secondary infections. A lot of this is due to behind-the-scenes work by the Ministry of Health, by the police forces, on doing things like the intensive contact tracing, which has been some of the secrets to success of the other East Asian countries.
I want to shift gears to talk about the importance of communications and messaging, actually. I think about how this week Boris Johnson had this huge press conference, and this is where Ollie can weigh in. And he was supposed to talk about lifting lockdown, but it almost sounded like he was talking about tightening lockdown. And so much of government communications is key in shaping expectations and behavior of people and businesses. So Ollie, when Boris Johnson said stay home, save lives has to change to stay alert and control virus, how are people reacting to that? Can you give us an insight into the practicalities and politics of this announcement?
Yes, and if you don't mind, I'll step back a little bit. I think it's really important to get the timeline here and start to explain why people found some of the messaging confusing. We knew that Boris Johnson was going to deliver this speech on Sunday. There was lots of briefing given to the British newspapers in the run-up to the speech, and lots of headlines, therefore, printed freedom, !! Giving this idea that Boris Johnson was going to speak on Sunday and, you know, radically relax the British lockdown. Then when he did speak, it was clear that that was not what he was going to do at all. And in fact, he was effectively extending lockdown, but with some tweaking around outdoor exercise and with some tweaking in the tone of the government message to do with trying to encourage some people back to work. Now, he gave that speech Sunday night. The problem was that the actual documents setting out the exact details of what the rules and regulations now were weren't published until Monday afternoon. Into that vacuum, you had speculation running wild, hypothetical situations being discussed and not answered because we didn't have the documents yet. We also had Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, and I'm afraid he went on broadcast round on Monday morning and didn't quite seem on top of the detail. He said that you could meet both your parents in the park. Downing Street had to come out and say that is absolutely not the case. You cannot do that.
Right. So you think it's a problem of coordination as well as having enough channels? Governments, they have like daily press briefing. They are communicating directly through Telegram. Do you think that's going to help solve that challenge of clarity of message?
It's about clarity of message. We have that daily press briefing and we have those documents now about what you can and can't do. They're pretty clear. The problem was we had a government minister going off message and we had a vacuum into which speculation was allowed to start swirling. In terms of the message itself, that's quite controversial. Many people have said stay alert is not very clear. What does that actually mean? Other Brits have said, you know, I'm pretty clear myself about what being alert is and what it isn't. And I think what also the government is trying to do here is inject some trust into the British people that they can use their common sense. And Boris Johnson's used the phrase common sense repeatedly over recent days. The other thing the government says on its messaging is it is going to be more vague as you come out of lockdown and slightly harder to follow in terms of the details, just because when you're in lockdown and the message is stay at home, that's clear. When the message starts to change slightly and the emphasis is moving and some people are encouraged back to work and there's a bit more you're allowed to do outside, that's necessarily going to be slightly harder in terms of comms. There's a very real sense now that the government does want to trust the British people with a bit more common sense, that they've got the idea of social distancing. As the restrictions ease, they're going to be able to take sensible decisions.
So Pauline, has the messaging been clear from a Singapore perspective about what needs to be done after lockdown, even after the circuit breakers lifted, before the circuit breaker was even imposed?
I'd like to pick up on Ollie's point. Precisely because the strict rules are easier to police, because you just say, stay at home, not allowed to go out. But the moment you lift and you expect people to remember that we are still in a COVID crisis, you have no choice but to trust, right? Because we have 5 million people roaming around. You have no choice but to trust that the average person on the street will be able to remember what the rules and regulations are and self-police. This is, you know, the difficulties that we have. Is it because the messaging is not clear? I think there's only so much you can do in terms of spelling out, you know, two steps forward, one step to the left, one step to the right, because exigencies emerge and people just revert back to old habits. But the other consideration, and this is to me, you know, as a Singaporean, really, really worrying, Singapore succeeded because we shut our borders and then we were able to contain somewhat the spread in the community. But given the way we are, we have very little resources besides, you know, human resource. It's not a sustainable state of affairs for Singapore. We have to open up. At some point, we have to be able to get flights coming in and people coming back from Malaysia. And we have to get that healthy flow back in so that we can survive.
I have to bring this up to a wrap because we're running out of time, but I do want to get your last sense as we wrap up on what do you think then is the best case scenario when countries are lifting restrictions, lockdowns, and sort of what are the key vital ingredients of a successful strategy? Maybe Alex can start us off first.
No countries really know what that success is going to be. Maybe following how Korea has managed to come back from its first wave, they've had mass testing and then similar to what we've done and what China have done, quite strong isolation quarantine measures. So I think that would be something that we should be aiming for going forward.
Testing is definitely going to be key. We do now have mass testing ramping up in the UK. The government's been criticised for not getting it going much more quickly. We also now have an antibody test has been approved by health officials here in the UK that they hope can be sent out to millions and millions of people in the British population. And Boris Johnson has always said that idea of being able to test who has had the virus, it could be potentially a game changer in how the country moves forward. Travel is going to be very, very interesting to watch in Europe. We are in a situation in which the UK is saying international arrivals at some point will have to be quarantined, but it's also saying that won't apply to people coming from France in a reciprocal arrangement. Well, the French are opening their borders with Germany in the not too distant future. So if you're trying to get from Germany to the UK, do you just go through France? Some of those southern European countries are desperately trying to open their borders so they can have their summer tourism season. It's going to be very, very messy indeed, I think, trying to keep a lid on international travel on the European continent. So that's something I think will be key to keep an eye on.
In order to survive this, I think all of us have to step up to be the effective community social busybody, right? To be able to politely and effectively say, don't stand so close to me, please. And just follow the rules. We'll get through this somehow.
Thanks to Pauline, Alex and Ollie for joining us today. There you have it from the experts on the big challenges ahead in lifting lockdowns and restrictions when normal after COVID-19 isn't really normal. Heart of the Matter is available on the CNA website and app under the podcast tab. Subscribe to us also on Spotify or iTunes so you don't miss an episode. The team behind this podcast, Christina Robert, our podcast editor, and research writer Erin Lowe. I'm Lynn Suling, signing off.